Hey everyone, welcome back to this week's episode of The Greek Current. I'm your host Thanos, and I'm joined here at Halcott Quarters by Georgia Logothetis. Hey,
hi.
Georgia.
Hi everyone. Hi.
And we're pleased to be joined this week. Calling in is journalist Patrick Strickland, journalist and producer at Al Jazeera English Online. He's currently primarily based out of Athens, Greece, where he's been covering the far right, the trial of Golden Dawn, and the broader European struggle against neo-fascist groups. He's also the author of a new book, which we recommend you take a look at, maybe on Amazon or at a library, Alerta, Alerta, Snapshots of Europe's Anti-Fascist Struggle. And Patrick, we're excited to feature you on this week's episode of The Greek Current, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
So, Patrick, you've been covering Golden Dawn while you've been stationed in Greece, its activities, the ongoing trial against it for some time now. Give our listeners a sense about what Golden Dawn is, its ideology, how it began, and its rise to prominence. Kind of a Golden Dawn 101.
Yeah, well, Golden Dawn started as a National Socialist journal in 1980. And then throughout that decade, sort of morphed into a loosely knit political organization. It was an association, actually, as such. And I think in 1985, it first registered. It was, as far as we can tell, and as far as I can tell from others who were researching it at the time, a pretty small group then. But then it sort of rose in size quite a bit. It swelled in size quite a bit during the 1990s. And then finally, of course, during Greece's crisis, it wasn't actually registered as a political party until 1993. So its very roots draw from National Socialist literature. Its earliest publications delved quite a bit into Holocaust denial, praise for Hitler, praise for Hitler's deputy, Rudolf Hess, and things like this. And then also drawing on a message that was very markedly pro-junta for the Greek military regime, and pro-Metaxas for the wartime dictatorship or the interwar dictatorship in Greece, and of course during the early years of the crisis, it kind of shocked. I wouldn't say just Greece, but especially Greece, it shocked the world by coming to prominence in the parliament. In 2012 elections, there were two elections that year, and they had a strong showing in both, and they entered the parliament for the first time. Mm-hmm. Though they had been around, of course, for a long time, and everybody knew who they were by that time because they had sort of been engaging in these vigilante attacks in Athens and elsewhere quite a bit. And of course, there's like a 1998 incident in which they attacked a group of students in central Athens. A group of Golden Dawn members did during a PAME rally or strike and left one of them in a coma. So they were, they were quite notorious, but then I don't think that many people expected them to be able to infiltrate the parliament, which they did very successfully in 2012, and then entered the following year.
We saw the rise of the Golden Dawn. We saw the headlines, obviously, the concern. And for many Greeks, I mean, Greece is a country that has a history of fighting against fascism. If you look back in the 1940s, the German occupation was especially rough on Greece. So what do you see as attracting people to this ideology? Is it the migrant crisis? Is it the economic crisis? Is it a combination of both? Or do they actually believe in this National Socialist rhetoric?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's important to note that while Golden Dawn now is like the third largest party in the parliament, it's still quite a small number of people compared to other mm-hmm. parties. You know, I mean, it is, they have a sort of hardcore, which are diehard loyalists. But I think that during the parliamentary elections of 2012, both of them, and then later in 2015, they really just kind of rallied around a combination of the crisis and of the economic crisis and migration. So in a way, I want to say it's both of those and neither, because they were you know, at the end of the day, they don't offer an economic alternative. And Greece's migration problem, I mean, you have since 2015 only around 65,000 refugees, which is quite a small number that could be absorbed quite easily. I mean, I think I read somewhere once that there's like 4,000 empty buildings just in Athens. So if those buildings were to be repurposed, theoretically, you could not only house all homeless Greeks, but also probably a large portion of the refugees and migrants who are in the Athens area as well.
And I'm going to jump in real quick. So I think you bring up a good point about how Golden Dawn is kind of has this outsized PR effort where they seem to project a lot larger strength in numbers than they actually have public support. And we saw, as you mentioned, 2013, when they first entered parliament, people were shocked by the numbers, but their poll numbers have been going down. But they've still kind of claimed this outsized support, primarily based on the fact that, there's still migrants in refugee camps and they still have this stranglehold essentially in pockets of Greece. But I want to get back to the point that you had made about how it's neither. And I think that's an important one because we saw people that were attracted to Golden Dawn that have kind of fallen out of love with them, so to speak. And one of the things that we've discussed here at headquarters quite often is that I think Golden Dawn came in at a time in terms of, their PR efforts during the crisis. They employed kind of the Hamas model, right? So at a time when government was slashing budgets, at a time when austerity was at the height, at a time when people were, begging for money on the street, they went in with loaves of bread in neighborhoods, right? And I think a lot of the goodwill that they got initially in some of the neighborhoods in Greece didn't really have to do with that fascist ideology. I think it had to do a lot with, well, here's this group, the government's not there for me, and they're giving me bread, or they're giving me cash.
They're walking old grandmas.
Or they're walking old grandmas. Exactly, exactly. It was that type of PR effort that made it seem like, well, we are the solution, even though we have this vile ideology, we also help you in your daily life. And I think a lot of people didn't really accept the vile ideology, but viewed Golden Dawn as a temporary solution. And I think that's why we've seen their numbers erode a little bit as the government has stabilized and their policies have stabilized as well. But I'd love to hear your thoughts on that PR strategy, the idea that a group whose ideology is based on hatred, right, and hurting other people, essentially, kind of projected itself as being this community problem solver.
Yeah, of course. I mean, so that firstly, that's not unique to Golden Dawn, this kind of strategy. It's one that, even dates back to the 30s and kind of pre-war fascism. But in a more contemporary sense, it's something that we also see in Italy with Casa Pound, self-described fascist party. Mm-hmm. And they've done things, which is this one I found quite interesting, but they've occupied abandoned apartment buildings. It provided residence for working class Italians, which is obviously something that leftists and anarchists also do. The key difference being that they only do it for Italians, ethnic Italians, right? We used to see the same thing with Golden Dawn when they would have things like food drives or soup kitchens and stuff mm-hmm. like this. And I remember even blood drive. But it was just for Greeks. Mm-hmm. And so, still underlying, while they want to do these kind of, public outreach things and whatnot, still underlying it that the exclusionist ideology is always present. They can't rid themselves mm-hmm. of it. And it was very effective for a time. Although I would say that I haven't seen much of that kind of stuff in the last year or two. And that could be because they are financially strapped because of the ongoing trial. That could be, for whatever reason, internal discord within their ranks. It could be a variety of reasons.
No, but that's a great point about how Golden Dawn has changed in the last 2 years mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. of the trial and the government crackdown.
Yeah, and that's where I want to jump into and discuss the trial, actually, because you don't see it often that a political party is mm-hmm. is taken to court. And is
well, it's
tried.
Not often that a political party is a criminal organization,
exactly.
But I guess here we have a unicorn.
But what prompted the government then of Andoni Samaras and New Democracy mm-hmm. to bring Golden Dawn's leadership to trial?
by the time that Golden Dawn was put on trial, which was sparked by the killing of Pablo Sfesis, the 34-year-old anti-fascist rapper in Ketatsini. They had been engaged in such a long strain of violence for such a long time with almost impunity, right? And if you look at the court documents now, you can see, I think the question is not, you know, why were they put on trial? It's why weren't they put on trial sooner? Mm-hmm. And the answer to it comes out in the court documents. And that's because there's quite a great deal of impunity for them, largely owing to situations where you had very close ties with mid-ranking and sometimes, and obviously low-ranking and sometimes a little bit higher-ranking people in the police force and local police departments. There's a guy called Develecos. I believe he's from the Perez branch of Golden Dawn. And in the wiretapped phone calls that were introduced earlier this year into the trial, you could see that he was coordinating directly with the riot police, with Matt. And they were, actually feeding him the coordinates of of an anti-fascist protest in Athens after Fesis was killed. So even after Fesis was killed, it wasn't totally severed right away. And I don't think it ever will be. But that's another topic. Mm-hmm. So the way that I would frame it is, kind of why weren't they put on trial sooner? I mean, and 9 months before Pablo Sfesis was killed, two guys stabbed seven times a 26-year-old Pakistani worker called Shahzad Luqman in Athens or near Athens, and he died on the spot. And they were arrested, obviously, and when they were arrested, the police found Golden Dawn memorabilia in their homes, weapons, Golden Dawn literature, all sorts of stuff. But there was no kind of drive to crack down on the organization itself. I think it was the killing of Fesis that was the final straw. For years, the pogroms were far-reaching. The Egyptian fishermen who in Piraeus and elsewhere who were attacked very often. I mean, there were some horrifying documents in the trial and the evidence about attacks on people who were sleeping and so on. And of course, I mean, those things haven't totally ended since the trial started.
I think it's important to know, when people think about putting a political party on trial, mm-hmm. that these weren't rogue actors, all these heinous acts that you're mentioning, these murders, these assaults. They weren't done outside of the Golden Dawn framework. In fact, violence is part of their ideology, mm-hmm. and intimidation and, going around the streets, as thugs looking for people to beat up. Like, it's not like the senior leadership of the organization was clueless about this. I mean, it was part and parcel of their framework, right?
Yeah, and I think that everything that we can see from, say, the investigative journalism of Dimitri Sipsaras, who wrote the book, the Black Bible of Golden Dawn, from the documents and surveilled phone calls and SMS messages that were entered into evidence in the trial, from other kind of investigative reporting, from leaks, is that almost no decisions were made without approval from very high up. And even in my own reporting, when I speak to people who were formerly in influential positions within Golden Dawn, say on the Central Political Committee, the impression that I get is that it was a very internally autocratic organization as well. So that, for instance, it would be kind of inconceivable that a high-profile attack wouldn't take place without the approval of someone very high up, or even Michaliakos himself.
Mm-hmm. And Michaliakos, who's the party leader, organization leader, rather. I don't know if we want to give them the political party label anymore.
Let's talk a little bit about the trial and why it's taking so long, because that was the focus of your article, and that's what caught my attention, because you already mentioned how the police force was enabling Golden Dawn's action. So now we're going to turn to the court system and see why is the trial.
Right. So, and for those who want to find the article, it's titled When Prosecuting Far-Right Violence Fails. It's in the New Republic. And yeah, I think you raised the right question in it and ask what are the dangers of the delay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so, well, what I hope to have done in that story was exactly that, to raise the question of what exactly are the dangers and to point out what's already happening, which is that for the last year or so, I've encountered quite a few people who are somehow linked to the trial, either as witnesses or as lawyers in the civil suit portion of the trial, who have been attacked or targeted with threats in various incidents. And the reason why it's taking so long, I mean, there's a combination of reasons. And I think one has to do with the nature of Greek bureaucracy, that these sort of things don't move very quickly in Greece, especially such a massive trial. The other is the sheer volume of evidence that's been entered into the trial. I mean, it's thousands and thousands of documents and hundreds of witnesses who have to testify on both sides for the prosecution and the defense. And then finally, I would say that there seems to be a pretty good indication that the defense has been stalling quite a bit and using various tactics by ordering a review of seemingly irrelevant documents from, you know, Parliament and things like this. I mean, that was addressed in a statement that's cited in the article that was put out by the 12 of the civil suit lawyers for that portion of the trial. And they basically said that they were calling on the court to allow for daily hearings and to allow for an expedited process in which they could hopefully wrap it up much sooner. Because when the trial started in 2015, all the predictions at the time were that it would take between 18 months and maximum 2 years. And of course, now it's been
almost well
over 3 years. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. You point out, I'm just pulling the stats from your article right now, that the court has held more than 253 hearings.
Wow.
250 prosecution witnesses have taken the stand. Opposing legal teams have entered into evidence tens of thousands of documents, and there's at least 230 defense witnesses waiting to testify.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only about 8 or 10 hearings taking place each month.
Wow.
Right. And I,
so just so,
I would
so
have
someone
to go
can
back
understand
and check
the magnitude of what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have to go back and check, but also, I mean, at the time of writing, all of the judges who were working on the trial also, they hadn't been freed up of all their other activities, mm-hmm. also, you know, their other duties and stuff. So that was one of the things that the prosecution lawyers from the civil suit part of the trial asked for, is to basically allow the judges to just focus on this trial so that there'd be some hope of finishing it before, you know, who knows, 2020. Because I read it, I think in Ekaterini, they predicted that now it may stretch even into 2020.
What have you observed in terms of continuing violence from the right, extreme right wing and Golden Dawn supporters during the trial? And how has that manifested itself? Is that one of the dangers of the delay that they'll continue with impunity?
Yeah. So, I mean, just in my own editorializing of the situation is that I don't think that people join Golden Dawn unless they have a proclivity towards violence or believe that their situation in which, violence is permissible in the manner that Golden Dawn uses it. And that's because there's a whole swath of right-wing and far-right political parties in Greece that they could join that aren't openly engaged in this kind of violence. So I think that you have a sort of conundrum for Golden Dawn. They're on trial. It's clearly bad for them to continue to be engaged in violence during that trial. But at the same time, they have a core group of followers who are like jackboots. I mean, they joined the party for that reason. You know, they didn't join the New Right or some other party where, you know, you're not in the streets, and able and willing to engage in confrontation. So in the scope of my reporting on far-right violence in Greece, it's definitely not limited to Golden Dawn. It never was, even during the height of the violence in 2012, 2013. There's always been individuals who engage in, you know, racist attacks, anti-migrant attacks, and so on. But there's also been other organizations. Sometimes it's hard to see where one starts and the other stops. So I think you have that tension, right? Like the people who are at the bottom, the street level folks, they need confrontation, or else they'll go elsewhere for that. And the violence has often been unclaimed in the situations that I report on. So last year and this year, there was a whole spate of very, very violent attacks on Pakistani migrant laborers in Aspropagos and Goritza and Manithi areas around Athens, places where Pakistani workers work either in factories or agricultural fields. And none of them were claimed by anyone. But oftentimes, like in Goritza, what happened was during the arrest of the suspects, they found Golden Dawn literature in the homes and stuff. So it's not a situation that's that unique in the sense that, I mean, in many different places, including here in the United States, you have situations where people are inspired by a certain group or person and maybe didn't actually have any tangible ties to them. So what I would say is that Golden Dawn, even though we definitely can't pin the blame for all far right or racist mm-hmm. or anti-migrant violence on them, we can definitely say that they tilled the soil, that they created the atmosphere in which it was normalized, permissible, and tolerated by a large part of society and for a long time, a large part of the state.
I want to take this time now and kind of shift over and look with a broader lens at Europe and highlight your book as well, Alerta, Alerta, Snapshots of Europe's Anti-Fascist Struggle. Mm-hmm. Lay out what the scope of the study of the book was and what you've seen across Europe in terms of far-right groups organizing, governments and grassroots working to combat that, you know, extreme right-wing rhetoric.
Okay, yeah. Well, so the book set out to flip the focus that's often employed during this kind of reporting from focusing on far-right groups themselves and instead profiling people who fight back against them in myriad ways. And so I took a really broad approach to what anti-fascism is. That's because I personally think fascism or National Socialism or neo-fascism are ideologies to which there is no indifference. So that if you don't identify as such, then you're an anti-fascist. It's sort of in your DNA. So with that, I basically wanted to look at people who fight back in very, very different ways. So obviously in Greece, you have a very militant anti-fascist movement that involves the participation of anarchists, also others on the left, whether they be communist or socialist of different stripes, who engage often in street confrontations. Sometimes they do blockades, for instance, from 2015 or 16, when they did a blockade on the office of Le Pen, a Golden Dawn splinter group, kind of. It was founded by a former Golden Dawn member, and they basically blockaded his office that he was trying to open and prevented that from happening and forced him to move. But at the same time, I wanted to look at people who push back in different ways that are creative. So you have the chapter on Germany, which focuses largely on a 71-year-old lady called Irmela. And for the last three decades, she has gone around and painted over neo-Nazi or anti-Semitic or anti-refugee graffiti in Berlin and elsewhere in Germany, and even a little bit in other countries as well. In Slovakia, I told the story of a retired phone technician who His son made him a Facebook after he retired, and he didn't really know what to do with it, and he was kind of bored. And then he ended up just tracking Slovak far-right extremists who were going to fight in Ukraine. He ended up kind of starting this blog where he would document the ties between far-right politicians in Slovakia and extremists elsewhere. He would sometimes dox them to dump their public information. For instance, if there were anonymous or pseudonymous Facebook accounts, and he was able to discover through his own investigations that they were operated by someone who's sitting in parliament, he could then, you know, expose that person as having violated the law, for instance, if they promulgated Holocaust denial. In Italy, I spoke to a lot of people, but one of the most interesting people was Delmo Cervi. He is the son of seven very infamous anti-fascists who were killed by Mussolini's forces in, I believe it was 1943, in Italy. And so he kind of spent his whole life trying to keep the legacy of his father and six uncles alive. And he today is quite old himself, but he goes around, and as there is a kind of surging far right in Italy, you know, he goes around and tries to warn people about the dangers of that. So that was the spirit of the book. I wanted to look at people who push back in very, very different ways. You know, if you look at Greece, there's several different people that I spoke to. Some of them were immigrants themselves. One was the mother of Pavlos Fissas. I mean, she has been one of the most prominent voices in speaking out against Golden Dawn. So that was the approach that I wanted to take, and hopefully that I hope I succeeded in it.
The vignettes of these people that are standing up against fascism across Europe is fantastic. And I want to bring us stateside here to Charlottesville. This week, we saw the opening statements and jury selection for the Charlottesville car attack, the death of one of the people who was protesting fascism in Charlottesville. And people may not know this, but there was a Golden Dawn connection, right, with some of the people who showed up in Charlottesville?
Mm-hmm. Well, something that's quite interesting is Matthew Heimbach, who is a very, he was for quite a long period, a pretty prominent voice within the so-called alt-right. He went on Vice right after Heather Heyer was murdered and said that him and others were trying to emulate the model of the Golden Dawn and other European nationalist parties. That's how he phrased it. And so that was interesting because Mr. Heimbach has a long history of ties to the Golden Dawn. He had visited Michaliakos in Athens. He was received actually in their parliamentary office the day before Charlottesville. You would have to fact check me on the exact wording of the title, but the Golden Dawn's magazine ran an article that was something like the South will rise again, or the South is kicking again, or something like this. And it was a kind of glowing profile of Heimbach. And so that connection was there, and he had been visiting and kind of trying to be a kind of American version of Golden Dawn for quite some time with his Traditionalist Workers Party, which is now defunct. So he failed in that. But the conditions were very different in the United States. So I don't think that approach was suited for success here. But interestingly, to tie it back where we were earlier in the conversation, he also tried to engage in this kind of community outreach, food drives, this kind of stuff. But it seemed that most of it was purely PR and didn't win many people over. But the Golden Dawn fits into a much broader international kind of connection. I mean, in the United States, Golden Dawn has links that go back, or ideological links at the very least, to groups from even the 1980s, like the Order, which was a white nationalist terrorist group that engaged in murder. In 1998, they hosted in Thessaloniki at a very secretive conference, William Luther Pierce Jr., who was an infamous white nationalist who's now dead, Throughout kind of the 90s and 2000s, early 2000s, there's a lot of like mutual sharing of text, of translating, you know, North American white nationalist literature. So, for instance, even Mihalyakos is believed to have ghostwritten a book that was based on a very infamous racist novel called The Turner Diaries. It's kind of like a Greek plagiarism of The Turner Diaries, which is The Turner Diaries, of course, here in the United States has been cited as motivation for various violent and often deadly white nationalist groups or neo-Nazi groups. It envisions a future of race war.
I've always found the anti-immigrant extremism in the Greek American community from these Golden Dawn Greek Americans hilarious because they completely forget their history. I mean, there was a time in American history when the Greeks were the ones who were being
not welcomed,
attacked by violent mobs. We couldn't even declare ourselves white on the census. And they just, you know, not to make a pun, but they whitewash over that whole entire history of how Greeks were the other for so long in the United States.
And along with other immigrant groups.
Exactly. Yeah. Italians, lots of Eastern Europeans. And now they kind of sit on a high step and proclaim themselves the master race. I just find that part of the Greek American experience is just fascinating to me that they just ignore that part.
For sure. It's definitely interesting, too, to see that U.S. Golden Dawn link. And it made me think, to go back to your book, do you see these neo-fascist far-right groups working together on a European level, whether it's EU Parliament or just exchanging ideas at forums, sharing their ideologies, their writings? I know we even discussed on the phone yesterday, Patrick, with President Orbán of Hungary, who sent a letter of support to some Golden Dawn representatives in the EU Parliament.
I mean, this has been going on for a long time. So, I mean, some people long before I ever wrote about the subject kind of called it the Nationalist International or the Brown International. And the thing that I find challenging about it is to see whether or not these links go beyond the ideological or those of expressions of solidarity. I mean, Golden Dawn is linked to far right and neo-fascist groups in almost every country in Europe. Golden Dawn, of course, is going to throw themselves behind a successful far right.
They'll latch on to anyone's PR. Orbán. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, anything that kind of somewhat aligns with their message. I mean, for instance, now if you read their website in Greek, I mean, there's pretty constant condemnations of the United States as well. And like, for instance, about U.S. involvement, let's say in Syria or whatever, right? So you'll see like very sharply worded articles about Trump. Whereas like, you know, when Trump was elected, they tried to latch onto it and they marched to the U.S. embassy with pro-Trump and make America great again kind of stuff. I mean, so a lot of it's PR. And then in other cases, like with Orbán, I think it's an actual alignment of ideas. Well, at the same time, though, what shocked me about that was Mr. Orbán then in turn responding to them and kind of dignifying Golden Dawn. That did kind of catch me off guard. I thought it was a level that we probably wouldn't see, especially given Hungary's very close ties to Israel. So with all of that said, I mean, the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, I couldn't envision a situation in which they openly interact with Golden Dawn. Even Le Pen in France has rejected or dismissed claims of cooperation with Golden Dawn, though of course there is an ideological overlap and that's kind of inescapable. But I couldn't see a situation in which the new wave, they're not new, but the newly successful wave of far-right populist parties, which have an ideology that draws mostly on anti-Muslim or anti-Islam or Islamophobic ideas and anti-immigration and kind of civic nationalism and all of this, I couldn't see a situation in which they're openly cooperating with Golden Dawn, at least not at the present. But with that said, that's largely because I think that Golden Dawn is incapable of reform. Its ideology and its very core is National Socialist. Of course, at some point they started saying that they were not National Socialist, but Social Nationalist. That's not too convincing,
yeah,
I guess.
That was so, so funny. I just love how they constantly try to twist their words or their actions, how they were like, well, this isn't a Nazi salute. It's like an ancient Greek way of saying hi.
Right.
Like,
it's, and this isn't, yeah, this doesn't mimic a swastika. It's a Greek key.
Yeah, from... I mean, it's ridiculous. But, you know, I want to end on a positive note. And I think it's important to note that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And I think we've seen, you made a point earlier on the show where you said that, you know, the people who are going to join Golden Dawn have already kind of this violent tendency or are attracted to that type of thing. I think that when we see the rise of fascism, the rise of nationalism, the people, it's not that new people are being converted. I think there's always been that element in society, this, you know, afraid of the other, afraid of change, afraid of progressive ideals, this kind of cowardly strain that resorts to violence as an expression of their ideology. And I think what the only change that we've seen is that they're getting to the polls more than they used to, right? They're feeling emboldened, and every election emboldens them a little more, or, you know, energizes another part of the base, and they get out to the polls. But I think what we're starting to see, and, you know, Charlottesville was an example of that, where there was the Unite the Right rally and they showed up to counter protest peacefully. We're starting to see a reaction to this strain that's taken hold in democracies across the world. In Greece, there's so many fantastic groups that are working to promote democratic ideals, that are working to promote Western values of inclusion, of progressivism.
Yeah, across the board, I was just going to add, you know, the whole continent of Europe and in the United States, obviously. And we saw in the midterms, too, the reaction of people showing up to the polls.
Yeah, so what positive takeaway do you have from your research of how the ground may be shifting in the future?
Yeah, so I actually think that I have to just open the book here to look, but the first line is about how anti-fascism is succeeding, whether it's here in the United States or on the streets of Athens, Greece. And I took that, you know, I came to that conclusion because as far as I see it, people are always going to fight back in one way or another to ideologies of hatred and exclusion and supremacy. I mean, when you talk about Greece, for instance, since the eruption of what's been called the migration crisis or the refugee crisis in 2015, Golden Dawn hasn't grown in size. And at the same time, there's been a huge outpour of solidarity. And I can remember even back in fall 2015 when people were showing up in Victoria Square in Athens to kind of protect refugees and migrants who were sleeping in the square as they were waiting to move on. I can remember also people doing much of the same earlier this year when there was a large nationalist rally in Athens and, hundreds of people basically came and just helped guard one of the squads at the City Plaza in downtown Athens where something like 350 refugees live. And that was just to, you know, to make sure that it was careful and that those people weren't attacked. And so I think that that's very impressive. And that's one of the things that attracted me to reporting more about Greece. It was the positive aspect and not the negative one. And you can see pushback everywhere. I mean, and it comes in so many different ways, but the important thing is that it's always present and that when it's not present, it presents a huge danger. Here in the United States, of course, it's a really different situation. And the far right has kind of receded from the public view to some extent since Charlottesville. I mean, there was such a wave of backlash, not just from the public, but and not from the state as much as many would have hoped. But, for instance, they were kicked off websites. Tech companies were booting them. They were kicked off social media outlets. And so their platforms were revoked left and right. And that had a huge impact on them. So there was, you know, all of this positive, in the midst of a horrible, horrible and horrifying situation. I think that it does present different challenges moving forward. I mean, for people, of course, I'm not an activist. I'm just a reporter. What I see is that when a big challenge for anti-fascists moving forward will be how to respond to groups like this and what role you can play when, on the one hand, their ideas have been to some extent institutionalized in the administration of Trump. And on the other hand, the more extreme elements go underground and they're not protesting, but they are carrying out kind of random attacks. Like, I mean, so that's a strategical question that anti-fascists will have to debate among themselves in the future. Because it won't be confrontation in the streets like what happened in Charlottesville, because they're not in the streets that much anymore.
Thanks again, Patrick. Again, I want everybody to share the title of the book with everybody. Alerta, Alerta, Snapshots of Europe's Anti-Fascist Struggle. Check it out on Amazon. Thank you, Patrick, for joining us again on our podcast. We really appreciate all the insight. I think we've got a lot of material for our listeners, and I think they'll enjoy it. And we really hope to get you back on in the future. You can update us as
never-ending Golden Dawn trial.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it's done by then. So,
but thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your insight with our listeners. We appreciate it.
Cool. Thanks for having me on.
All right, guys. Thanks again. That wraps up this week's episode of The Greek Current.